Listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Bruce Kuwabara celebrated Canadian architect and the mind behind Agnes Reimagined, the new home of the Agnes Etherington Art Center, is this year's Francis K. Smith Lecturer in Canadian Art. In his talk, Catalyzing Change, Kuwabara presents several recent projects that explore the themes of art and community and the insights he gained working on Agnes Reimagined. Join us on Thursday, March 20th at 6 p.m. in Grant Hall for this exciting event. Tickets are free, but please register by visiting agnes.queensu.ca.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus community radio station, broadcasting to you since 1922.
Good morning, it is 11 a.m. and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. The Frontenac Lennox and Addington Ontario Health Team has greatly surpassed original targets, connecting over 13,000 residents across the region to primary care providers in 2024. The FLAOHT is a network of healthcare providers, community and social service organizations, and community members working together to make healthcare more accessible in the region. Much of their work has been following the school zone model championed by Dr. Jane Philpott, former dean of the Queen's Faculty of Health Sciences and current chair of Ontario's Primary Care Action Team. This reorganization involves geographic rostering, so community members can access primary care close to where they live in a health home, a home base for access to all necessary healthcare and wellness services. FLAOHT has been supporting existing primary care clinics to become health homes, while also creating new health homes to increase the number of primary care teams in the region. In spring 2024, FLAOHT announced that they would be attaching up to 9,000 residents to primary care in the coming year. Through creative and collaborative efforts, they have already managed to surpass this goal by approximately 4,000 residents. In their release, FLAOHT included some of their 2024 highlights, listing multiple health homes that managed to take on the entire waitlist of residents in their area registered on attachment tool Healthcare Connect. CDK Kingston Health Home alone attached 4,187 patients, including all of those registered on Healthcare Connect in its neighborhood. Prior to this effort, an estimated 30,000 residents, approximately 10% of the region's population, were without a primary healthcare provider. Dr. Kim Morrison, FLAOHT executive lead, spoke with CFRC about this achievement and what comes next. "You greatly exceeded the original goal of up to 9,000 patients attached to primary care, announced in spring 2024. What efforts contributed to this?"
"It's really been an effort on so many people coming together in partnership to be able to achieve this. As an OHT, we understand the value of primary care and people being connected there as their home base or their front door to the health system. And when we set our target a year ago to aim to attack 9,000 people, we knew it was going to take partners from across. So we have primary care leadership, we have allied health teams within primary care, we have our community health center. Then we also have partners such as hospitals, and community agencies, home care, Healthcare Connect, all coming together to work together, sometimes in different ways than they're used to be able to build that capacity so more people can be attached."
Mm-hmm. And what is generally different in this model compared to prior efforts to get folks attached to primary care?
Well, we're trying a variety of different models. So all of our health realms are doing slightly different things. Partnership with the municipalities, and your listeners will know across the province, there's this race to try and recruit doctors and the incentives that are out there. And our municipalities in our region have really partnered with other health system partners to say, how can we work together to get doctors and nurse practitioners to come and to stay? It's not only about recruitment of new, but retention of those that are there. And similarly, how do we work together with partners to make the job in primary care easier so that you can look after more people if you've got, as an example, a team of people to help care for an individual, or if you've got the digital tools that make your job easier so it can cut down on that administrative burden and the paperwork that's just becoming so overwhelming in primary care, and it just takes time.
Mm-hmm. And I can imagine it was a positive emotion, but how did you and your team feel when you got that news that you exceeded your goal by, I believe, 4,000 patients?
Well, I gotta say, it's a double-edged sword, to be fair. I mean, it's super exciting that we've been able to exceed what we aimed for, but it also tells me that we're perfectly capable of finishing the job and getting everybody attached. And that's so we can congratulate ourselves and our partners, and I'm hopeful our community is happy that we've done this, but it also tells me that there's a whole lot more work to do, and we're well set up to do that, to really truly get everybody attached to a health home. Then I'll be super duper excited.
Mm-hmm. And where does that leave us now? What's 2025 going to look like with these efforts?
So in 2025, I think there's lots of good things coming together. We've built a strong foundation on how to build capacity. We've just recently had a primary care summit where we brought our primary care leaders and partners together about what's next. How can we, attach the rest of the population? And we've got some really good ideas on how to do that together. We have the primary care action team, at the government levels with a mandate to attach everybody in Ontario. And so we're hopeful that there'll be provincial, well, we're confident, we're not even hopeful anymore. We're confident that there'll be provincial support for developing models that will allow us to attach the rest so we can build more capacity, we can build new infrastructure, we can expand our teams, we can include all of our primary care groupings in team-based care, which will help build capacity to reach that goal.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned you've kind of been, learning what works. What have you learned? What lessons have you taken from the successful past year?
Excellent question. We've learned that collaboration matters, and talking between patients and primary care providers is really important about what access means and what attachment means. We've learned that if you work together with allied health professionals, municipal partners, and others, then you can use resources that exist in different ways to build that capacity. And many of our examples, there's no net new funding. We're just working differently together to build that capacity so more people can call a primary care site home.
Yeah, and you've been doing a lot of different things. I was wondering if you wanted to share an example of how you've gotten creative this year.
Sure. So in Napanee, as an example, our primary care docs all came together and partnered with the community health center to create a model that allowed the physicians to work in a manner that acknowledged their administrative time and created space for people to have better work-life balance and use our resources better together. That's one example. In the city of Kingston, the Greenwood Health Home of the east end of Kingston partnered with the municipality and with hospitals, and really looked within themselves about how could they create a model that would attract more physicians to come and work for them without, I'll call it the burden of signing up to a new practice, but how can we work together in different ways with locums and expand that roster of people who belong to Greenwood so that they can access care better and keep the doctors that they've got and recruit more. The CDK Health Home or Limestone Faux did something very similar, and by taking on more patients, they were able to hire some allied health professionals to help look after those patients, because lots of things you don't need to see your family doctor about. You should see a social worker or a dietitian, so they could build their own team that way. And the Midtown Health Home is a brand new net new primary care site as part of the Kingston Community Health Centers that's on a salaried model. And it's very much a team from the get-go that's designed to look after that neighborhood in our city.
Once again, that was Dr. Kim Morrison, Frontenac Lennox and Addington, Ontario Health Team Executive Lead, on their recent announcement that 13,000 residents have been connected to primary care providers across the region in 2024. After 31 years of providing arts programming from their location at the corner of Princess and Victoria Street, the Kingston School of Art is giving up their space due to financial challenges. Founded in 1994, KSOA has served as a cornerstone of the local art community, providing accessible classes, supplies, and exhibitions, including their annual juried exhibition. However, the decision to leave their physical space does not mean KSOA is closing its doors. KSOA Board President Christiane Wojcik spoke with CFRC about the challenges that led to this decision and what's next for the school. I was wondering if you could speak to the financial challenges that led to this decision to move.
Sure. It's really a little bit complex. So KSOA is incredibly unique and really fortunate in one way, which is we were completely volunteer run for most of the 30-year history. And so what that means is we didn't have any employees that really belonged to KSOA until around 2020-2021. Everything that was done with KSOA was done through volunteer engagements. You know, obviously we had people that we paid. We employed teaching artists throughout that time, but we didn't have, say, like a director or administrative staff. The board of directors as volunteers were running everything. So that kept overhead costs really low because we didn't have salaries for staff who were really running all the mechanics of KSOA. And then during COVID, the previous board, so just prior to my time, really decided through some strategic analysis that for KSOA to grow, but also survive after COVID and be able to adapt to changing models and some complex funding, we needed staff. And so we hired staff at that point, and it's been an experiment for the last couple of years of us figuring out funding models and how do we keep paying our artists the wage that they are entitled to while keeping the cost of classes as low as possible so that we still fulfill our mission as a community art school. But things like overhead salaries and then over other increases just in the general cost of things. Our rent has gone up, utilities have gone up, materials costs have gone up, everything else. It's really made it difficult to make ends meet.
Mm-hmm. And how will KSOA continue to serve the community? What's the plan?
So it's still under development, but we're really excited about the steps that we're taking so far. So part of the plan is obviously to give up our physical space at Princess of Victoria. That was the public announcement just recently. But by no means means that we're closing. That facility has been amazing to us. We've actually been with the same landlord for 30 years. We've simply just outgrown the space in terms of the model, and we really feel like what the community needs from us. So we've spent a couple of months engaging with other partners in the art sector and really asking, what is the purpose of KSOA now? 30 years is a long time. We're older than the Tet Center. We're older than a lot of other arts sector availabilities and classes and things that you can do in Kingston. They weren't here when we started. So looking at 2025, you know, what does the community really need from us? We're a nonprofit charity, and if we don't really have a mission we're fulfilling, then maybe it is time to just bow out. But the message we've gotten was no, KSOA is needed, and we really need to go back to our core focus, which is in arts instruction. That's something that's just not happening within the community here through any other agency, the way that we do it and the way that we have mastered that for three decades. So the idea is to focus on arts instruction and to bring that into some underutilized spaces throughout the community. So what you would be looking to see from KSOA later in 2025 and then on into the future would be art classes being held in different spaces across Kingston, maybe areas of town where art classes are not currently being offered, in spaces, buildings that, you know, are closed for part of the week that might be perfect spots to create art and to bring people together, but they're just underutilized after hours or on weekends. And so that's what we really want to start later this year is, you know, getting rid of our own kind of overhead lease obligations and using other spaces more efficiently to bring arts more community-based. We're also working on some additional plans with a working group right now that includes representation from the whole art sector, as well as the city, local artists, and others, because we have one unique asset in our public sort of community engagement with the printmaking machines. So KSOA really started because we ended up in possession of quite an extensive set of printmaking equipment. So printing presses and everything that goes with that. All of these came from St. Lawrence College back in the early 90s when they closed their printmaking program. That is material that we can't exactly cart around town because it's thousands of pounds, literally, of material. So the side project we're working on is this working group to find a new home, a new purpose for all of this printmaking equipment. And so that may end up being a little side project of KSOA along with some of our partners, whether that's a printmakers guild or a community print shop that KSOA is running so that artists can continue to access that equipment. But it just makes more sense for our financial model.
Well, not having those lease obligations and finding more creative ways to use spaces, is that going to kind of cover those financial challenges that you're dealing with? Or will there have to be other changes, like changes to staff or things like that?
We hope that this does it. So right now we have gone back to a model where the board is running everything again. We're back to where we were a few years ago, where we do not have staff at this moment. That's certainly been a challenge for the board. We're volunteers and most of us work full time. So we're doing this with the time that we have to get this launched. We do expect to rehire a staff person as a operational coordinator with the new community-based model. But for the moment, it's all being run off volunteers. So we hope that by doing a little bit of a reset with our overhead expenses, staffing, et cetera, and using information we've been gathering over the last couple of months for what the highest in demand courses are, really concentrating our efforts around those things that the community wants for us, we think that that's going to be the ticket for stabilizing our finances and making a model that allows us to continue well into the future.
Mm-hmm. And you'll be moving forward, as you mentioned, hopefully with one staff member coming back. How many staff members did you have prior to these changes?
It changes throughout the year, particularly during the summer when we had been running things like summer camps, where we did have a number of student staff or summer staff. But we did have one full-time and one part-time staff member before these changes. One of those we did lose because of these changes, and the other was a temporary position that they've moved on to other employment here in the community, which we're happy about.
Mm-hmm. And we're kind of in this limbo phase right now. You mentioned the big print machines and all the other supplies that are currently at KSOA. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to where that's all at and how you guys are handling that.
Yeah. So it's a great question. There's a couple different pieces to it. So right now, actually, through the entire month of February and probably into March, we are doing an ongoing book and art sale. 30 years, you accumulate a lot of stuff, and some of it is great. To be fair, some of it ends up being dried out acrylics that we just are doing some clean out of things. But there's certainly things around there that local artists or enthusiasts would want to get their hands on. So anybody can stop by the Window Art Gallery, which is part of KSOA. That's the Victoria Street entrance to the facility. And there is an ongoing book and art sale in the WAG right now for the entire month of February. So it's pay what you can for most items. We have hundreds of art books. We have odd pieces of printmaking and art, things that are from classes, sample sales, all sorts of stuff that we've kind of dug out of the archives there in the physical space while we're starting to look at packing up and cleaning up 30 years worth of things in that creative space. So certainly we'd encourage anybody, if you're looking for art books, if you are a muralist, a collage artist, anybody who wants to take things, cut them up, there's books, huge books, as cheap as $5. For the most part, things are pay what you will. And we're using that money just as a fundraiser for the school and to help sort some of the costs that come with moving, like boxes and, you know, disposal fees. A lot of the assets we're going to be hanging on to and moving just into storage space. So things that are really essential to running art classes, like our easels, equipment that works well. So small art supplies, you know, various things like that. We're going to be moving into offsite storage. And then with the community model, we would be bringing those things to the places where we are teaching classes. There's going to be stuff that we are unloading. Right now, the board is talking about having a public sale probably in early April, and we'd be making an announcement about that on our social channels as well as our website, where this would be anything that we don't want to take with us that's still sort of we uncover that's useful. That could be art supplies, brushes, canvas, could be tables and chairs, fixtures, different things that we just feel it's time to let go of. We're planning for a public sale probably in early April that anybody who's looking for stuff for their studio is going to want to keep on their radar.
Once again, that was Christiane Wojcik, KSOA board president, on the school's decision to say goodbye to their home of 31 years. Wojcik also noted that art lovers can stay tuned for belated 30th anniversary celebrations in summer 2025. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for this morning, featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the City of Kingston. Friday, February 21st, we will see a daytime high of -4 with an overnight low of -12 and a mix of sun and cloud throughout the day. Saturday, February 22nd, slightly warmer, daytime high of -2, overnight low of -11 with cloudy conditions. And Sunday, February 23rd, daytime high of -2 with an overnight low of -7. This is Jesse Bell with the City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week of Monday, February 17th, 2025. We begin with road closures. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. In terms of parking disruptions, bear in mind the Hanson Memorial Parking Structure Restoration Project is now underway. The work will take place throughout all levels of the building and will include efforts such as routine structural maintenance, repainting, replacement of waterproofing materials, and upgrade to the building's mechanical and electrical systems. The work began in February 2024 and is set to conclude in July of 2025. Other road delays and closures you should be aware of. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club. Expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. Highway 2, Abidon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abidon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. New parking fine increases will be coming into effect this spring. The changes came before council at their meeting on Tuesday night, with the lengthy list of increases ranging from 25 cents to $4.50. Councillor Gary Osteroff raised concerns about the increases.
That's a lot of increases for the city. And I think that has a message to it that concerns me a little bit, and I think a lot of our community. So I'm just wondering if we can address that, and not one by one necessarily, but overall, why so many increases?
Laird Legault, manager of licensing, parking operations, and policy with the city, was present to answer questions and stated the following in response.
Now, the rationale for the increase overall is in order to maintain a stable contribution to our parking reserve fund to ensure that we have future funds for our capital and operating needs.
The last time parking fees were raised was in 2019. According to Legault, these new increases would represent a raise of approximately 3% per year since the last adjustment. The largest jump was in the fee associated with losing a ticket, which jumped from $18 to $22.50. Legault explained the reasoning for this jump when asked by Councillor Osteroff.
That doesn't feel fair to me. Like, why wouldn't we just go to $20? Or, you know, I'm just wondering about the impact, again, of frustrating Kingston's driving community.
We find that sometimes individuals claim that they've lost their ticket after they've been parked there for a couple of days. So, in fact, they're paying far less.
According to Legault, on average, Kingston's fees are still lower than most municipalities. Commissioner of Community Services Paige Agnew also offered some words to quell concerns.
So we did have a consultant work with the city to review the pricing for parking. That review obviously included best practices, but also looked at our financials and making sure that we can build proper financial models in the long term for asset management and also additional parking, because we expect that at some point in time we will need to invest in additional parking supply. So this model looked at all of those things to identify increases in costs.
While Councillor Osteroff still had concerns about the fairness of these changes, the motion was passed and new fees are set to come into effect April 1st, 2025.
We'd still want to create a community that's fair, and sometimes it from when I read it cold like this, it doesn't feel fair, but I guess I have to trust you with that you're also a driver and a parker. And
Kingston City Council unanimously voted in favor of a motion to develop a Shop Local campaign. This motion is specifically in opposition to the proposed 25% tariffs on Canadian goods by the United States. Councillor Wendy Steven brought forward the motion.
It's up to us to remind ourselves just how awesome it is to be a part of this community. And let's work together to keep our town vibrant. Let's rally around our local business owners and let's shop local.
Councillor Steven emphasized the urgency of supporting local businesses, a sentiment shared by many councillors during the discussion. Council also dove into the broader context of these U.S. trade policies.
We've all heard the comments about Canada becoming the 51st state and how President Trump thinks that Canada is not viable as a country. And I think we need to be crystal clear here that Canada will never be the 51st state. This is what the U.S. is trying to do. They are trying to use tariffs to bully us into becoming the 51st state because we have things that they want. Only it's not lunch money, it's natural resources.
Councillor Brandon Tozo, who seconded the motion, echoed these sentiments.
This motion is very near and dear to my heart, and I really share the feelings of many Canadians of a profound betrayal by the Trump administration. As Councillor Steven mentioned, we're being told that Canada is going to become the 51st state. That's not happening. Over my dead body.
Councillor Connie Glenn also pointed out that many businesses are just now bouncing back from the impact of the pandemic. And this added pressure only makes it more challenging.
So we've got businesses that are just getting into the stage of recovery after the pandemic. So to be hit by this, I think, is just another slap in the face. So anything that we can do to support them really matters.
The motion also has an element of advocacy to upper levels of government, calling for the removal of interprovincial trade barriers. Councillors Gregory Ridge and Vincent Shinani highlighted the practical importance of community support in this time.
If we're looking at the percentage of our workforce in Kingston who work in retail trade, it's approximately 12% of our workforce. If we're looking at people who work in accommodation and food services, it's approximately 10%. So you have 22% of our labor market that could be potentially affected just off the hop when we're talking about economic effects there, won't go into manufacturing or anything. And so I think a campaign to support local businesses right now is of the utmost importance. I think that it's not just something that we can do in a flag-waving, patriotic kind of way, but it's something that we need to do as a careful, focused economic strategy to help people in this time, because there will be changes. They may likely in the immediate be negative, and we need to be there to support each other.
when you support local businesses, they're the ones who, if they succeed, they're the ones who give back to the community. They're the ones who donate. They're the ones who sponsor sports teams. They're the ones who do a lot of like the community work because they care about the community. So the more we support them, the more they support the community. And regardless of tariffs and all that, this is just the thing that we should all be doing, regardless of what's going on in the world.
Mayor Brian Patterson provided the final comment of the night, noting that mayors south of the border have also been involved in discussions with neighboring Ontario municipalities.
It's just surreal that we're having to have this conversation, but I appreciate the motion. Certainly, I absolutely encourage everyone in our community to go out to support local, to shop local, to encourage visits to Kingston. The other thing I will say is that there are conversations that are happening among mayors, not only on this side of the border. There are conversations that are happening with some of my colleagues south of the border as well. Because there are many border communities to the south of us that are being absolutely negatively impacted by what's going on right now. And we do have allies.
A copy of the motion will be sent to stakeholders, including Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and various business associations, urging them to take action.
While all of this is out of our control, we know that at least by supporting Kingston's local economy, that is supporting Canada's economy. And that is actually within our control. So, leaving here tonight, let's shop local. Let's show our businesses some love. And let's get lots of tourists here to do exactly the same.
Kingstonians can expect to see an official Shop Local campaign launching soon. The Kingston Canadian Film Festival is returning for their 25th year with more local films on the docket than ever before. KCFF 2025 will present 5 Made in Kingston films, the most ever, at the festival next month, in addition to 8 short films produced through their local shorts program. This will also mark the world premiere for many of these films. This comes as Kingston's film sector is potentially on the cusp of some major growth. Ambitious actors in Kingston's film scene have been pioneering a new era, which includes an emphasis on homegrown start-to-finish productions and possibly a brand new film studio in town for this purpose before the year is up. Festival director Mark Garness spoke with CFRC about this year's elevated local film presence. This is the most local films to be featured at KCFF. I was wondering if you could speak to that and what it says about Kingston's film industry.
Yeah, well, I think when I started, my first year at the festival was 2000, and I started in 2012. My first festival was 2013, and we didn't have any local features that year. And it was in those early days for me, it was very rare to even see a local feature. We would maybe get one like every other year type thing, but we had a local shorts program, which that's been here for 25 years, and it's always been a really strong program. Oftentimes it's a lot of film students at Queen's creating those films, but one thing I've noticed is just more filmmakers living here year round and in the community making films. So I think like through Queen's there's always been a strong output of short films, but now we're seeing more shorts being created by people in the community. And then also the big thing I'm noticing is more features now. So like this year we have, I think we have four locally produced features. And last year, I think we had 3. So now it seems like year in, year out, we have a few features being made by Kingstonians, which was something I didn't see in my early days.
Mm-hmm. And has it been a kind of like a slow progression to get here, did you find, or was there kind of a big boom of local filmmaking?
Yeah, I would say it was more gradual. Like, I think when I started, it was just like, yeah, like I said, it was very rare to see a local feature. And then, I don't know, 1 year we maybe had 2, and then 1 year we had 3. And so it's kind of been gradual. And Kingston had its, got a film office. I think it was in 2019. So that certainly helped. And Alex was the original film officer as well. So and he's maintains a close connection to the festival to this day, and has been on the board and was the early director as well. So I know he's when he was in that role was always looking up for the festival as well. So yeah, I think now with more supports in place, like the film office, and then I think also locals knowing that there is a exhibition space for their films if they do create one, like knowing that KCFF will play them, I think is both those things have led to a higher output.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and it's the 25th anniversary. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the festival's growth and how that's kind of coincided or had a relationship with our local film industry growth till now.
Yeah, like it's so every year I've been with the festival, like other than the pandemic years, which just is not really a comparable, but every like, I guess, non-compromised festival has grown in attendance. And you know, just tying it back to the local stuff, I think anytime you can include a local film or more local talent in the lineup, it's bringing in people that may not show up otherwise. So, you know, for example, like we have an 18 millimeter program, which is youth filmmakers, and you know, they're bringing a mom and dad and brother and sister and friends and family that are there to support their kid, and they are often coming to the festival for the first time through that path. And then I think once they're there, they're like, oh, there's a lot more to this festival than I realized, and you know, maybe I'll go check out another film. So it's been, I think, including some of the local productions has been a way to provide a new point of entry into the festival for some people who've maybe known about it but have never actually taken a chance on it. So that's not why we do it, to grow the festival. We do it to support the local filmmakers, but it is a nice byproduct of including more local, is that I think our core audience does grow.
Garnis also included one of the local films in his highlights for this upcoming festival.
It's a tie between many things, but I would say Single Woman Seeking Child is one that I'm excited for, but also proud of. We had a 25th anniversary contest last year. It was a script reading contest where we had five people do live pitches in front of a jury, and Blaine Waters was the filmmaker who won. So we helped fund his new short film that's going to be playing at the festival this year. And yeah, it was all shot in Kingston. So you'll see like lots of downtown familiar landmarks. And it's a story about his family and him growing up here. And it's only 15 minutes, but he nailed it. It's amazing. It's got like the arc of like a full 90 minute feature film. I don't know if his intention is to make it into a feature or not. Like, it's pretty hot off the press. I know he's bringing his family over to the premiere at the festival. And so, yeah, it was just nice to be involved in it, going back to last festival and knowing that we had a hand in bringing this to life by funding it and then now premiering it at the festival. So I guess if I was forced to pick one, that would be the one I'm looking most forward to.
Once again, that was Mark Garnis, Executive Director of the Kingston Canadian Film Festival, on this year's record number of local productions being featured. The Kingston Canadian Film Festival has announced that the award-winning documentary Blue Rodeo, Lost Together will be the closing night film on Sunday, March 2nd. This screening will bring Blue Rodeo co-founder and Queen's University alumnus Jim Cuddy back to Kingston alongside co-founder Greg Keeler and director Dale Heslip. Cuddy and Keeler narrate the film, telling the story of Toronto band Blue Rodeo from their beginnings to their current status as one of Canada's most cherished bands. In anticipation of the event, we spoke with Jim Cuddy and director Dale Heslip about what festival attendees can expect. What can audiences expect from this film closing out KCFF this year?
Oh, I think it's fantastic that it's closing the Kingston Film Festival. I think it's fantastic that Jim and Greg went to Queens, so it's going to have this sort of this emotional connection, because it kind of all started there. It started on a car ride going from Kingston to Toronto, and they decided to make a band, and they've been together ever since. So we've been getting a lot of really great reaction to the film, and it played at the Whistler Film Festival in December. It played at the Salt Spring Film Festival just last week. It's playing the Hot Docs Theater Saturday night. Sold out. Jim, Greg, myself, and Erica M are going to do a Q&A. Then it's doing Cineplex across the country, 38 theaters across the country, February 2 and 3, before it comes to Kingston. So I don't know. The ticket sales have been going crazy. There's obviously a ton of Blue Rodeo fans out there. And I don't know. We really like it. I have to say, when we heard that the band liked the doc after we sent it to them, I was like, yes, thank God. But the fans have been reacting the same way. There's a real nice honesty to this doc, and it's a really nice way to get to know the band, that's for sure.
Yeah, and Jim, how is it for you to be, you know, reflecting back?
You know what? It was a real joy to go down memory lane to do the doc, but it also uncovered some uncomfortable times. I mean, I think in a 40 years span, life together, there are going to be some difficult times, and maybe those times were a little more difficult than I remembered. And so it was good to drop my suppressed guard and just take things for the way they were, because now they're good. And so it's easier to look back on the difficult times when times are rosy. So yeah, it's amazing. I think that Greg and I started as high school friends. And so I think that for any of this to have happened to us would be unimaginable. I think we both realized at a certain time we wanted to absorb ourselves in music for the rest of our lives. But whether we were going to be able to do that or not, who knew? And so to find ourselves here, even talking about a documentary, is full of gratitude and wonder.
Cuddy also dove into his time at Queens prior to Blue Rodeo and his roots in Kingston.
Right. Well, I graduated from Queens in 78, and Greg picked me up. And I told him that I wanted to devote 1 year to music, and then I would go to law school or something. And he said, well, let's get a band. And so from that car ride till now, we've had a band. So we planned a band. We got a band called the Hi-Fis. That played for about 3 years in Toronto. Then we moved to New York, and we had a band down there while my wife, girlfriend at the time, went to acting school. And it wasn't until we came back to Toronto in 84 and got the rodeo together in 85. So that had been, you know, I'd been out of school 7 years at that point. And it wasn't until that point that we got this band that we thought, wow, this is a really good band. I mean, we had Cleve and Basil, and then we had Bobby Wiseman. And I think no matter what had happened to us, we would have been happy that that band was so good and played our song so well. So, and then it goes from there, but that we had a very strong start. After 7 years of, you know, of meandering, we had a very strong start when we finally got Blue Rodeo together.
Well, how does it feel to be returning to Kingston after all these years?
Well, I love Kingston, and I probably play there once a year. Like my roots in Kingston go way back. My parents went to Queens. My dad came there. My mom was from Prince Edward County, so she obviously wanted to go to Queens and wanted to get out of Prince Edward County. And my dad came as a war vet, and they met and they married, and then they had their life, had their kids, they divorced. And then when we were young parents, when I was a young parent with my wife, my parents went back to Queens and remarried. So that's two marriages. My wife and I met at Queens, and now our youngest son, who just married his girlfriend, they met at Queens well. So we're three generations and four marriages, one couple twice.
Yeah, so it must be special to kind of, you know, be returning for this.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, I loved it. I loved it in Kingston. I love my years in Queens, and I love going back. There's something very inspiring about it. There's something very tranquil about it, and yet there's a lot of energy on the campus, and it's not too bro for me, and it's a great place.
Once again, that was co-founder of band Blue Rodeo, Jim Cuddy, and director Dale Heslip on the documentary Blue Rodeo Lost Together, closing out KCFF this year. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
We'll be right back. What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage funky one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present local indie folk band The Killdeer's second single, That One, released on Valentine's Day. A song about taking chances and following your heart. It's the most sentimental track yet and a lovely follow-up to their single The Escape, released in January. The release also features a special cello cameo by Danton Delchuk, adding an extra touch of warmth on these cold winter days. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream That One by The Killdeers on your favorite platforms and enjoy it with us right now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Falling asleep in the side by side in broken light, I catch your face in the window. Across town in darkness, slipping through the night, through the fog in my head, I want to remember I would stay here all night.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present The Pit, the first release into local punk and alt-rock band Sonic Souvenir's new era of their sound. The Pit, in the vision of its makers, marks a revolution in the professionalism and quality of their music and performance. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream The Pit by Sonic Souvenir on your favorite platforms and enjoy it with us here now on CFRC 101.9 FM. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present local rock band Pound Salt's latest single, Gonna Be Famous. The track is a celebration of ambition and self-indulgence. With lyrics laced with wit and a touch of grandeur, Gonna Be Famous is as catchy as it is confident, driven by hook-heavy instrumentals and ensemble vocals. The song came together almost instantly, fully embracing the band's indie DIY spirit, recorded in their practice space affectionately called the Salt Mine. They experimented with tracking instruments on their own before handing it over to Jeff Vandertote, whose expert touch helped shape the final sound. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via Visit Kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Gonna Be Famous by Pound Salt on your favorite platforms and enjoy it with us here right now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Kuwabara celebrated Canadian architect and the mind behind Agnes Reimagine, the new home of the Agnes Etherington Art Center, is this year's Francis K. Smith Lecturer in Canadian Art. In his talk, Catalyzing Change, Kuwabara presents several recent projects that explore the themes of art and community and the insights he gained working on Agnes Reimagined. Join us on Thursday, March 20th at 6 p.m. in Grant Hall for this exciting event. Tickets are free, but please register by visiting agnes.queensu.ca.
I'm Amy Good.